pleasure, right? Always. And
always good to see you.
Back to you, Ann.
This is a treat for me because you guys are like the epitome of what Eating as an Act of Worship Ministry stands for. We are family oriented organization. So it's a blessing to us when whole families get healthy and fit together. And one of the things, you know, that we love to tell people who take our class is, you know, that, you know, the world tells you to get healthy and fit for you. It's a real selfish, introspective thing. But the Lord says, you know, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And he also tells us that the first thing that we should do is love the Lord our God with all our hearts, all our souls, all our mind, and all our strength. And then the second one, Jesus said, is like it, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. And your neighbors, your closest neighbors, are your family members. And so when I think about the fact that Brother Moore had prostate cancer, and if he had not, first of all, been taking care of himself the way that he had, and then, you know, gotten screened and took care of the situation, it could have been so different. He may not have seen this moment with you. And so that's what we tell people in the class, that you are supposed to be healthy and fit, not just for yourself. Yes, you are to do it in part for you, because your body's the temple of the Holy Spirit, and we are the stewards of this place. So we're supposed to take care of it for the one true living God, but also for your daughters, for your sons, for your spouses, for your parents, your siblings, your friends, your coworkers, your community. And Brother Moore, it's just a blessing to have you guys, especially here in Prostate Cancer Month, to be, you know, the evidence of that. Had you ever thought of it that way? You know, that if you hadn't had that test, you hadn't gotten treated, you might have missed this moment with your daughter.
You know, let me tell you about this moment. I'm normally prepared for every call. Mm-hmm. And I realize I'm not prepared today because I don't have a tissue. you know, I am an emotional person, but
yes.
I keep a wipe in my eyes because I am so proud.
Praise God.
Of what he's done. And yes. To your point, had I not been treated, in fact, I lost a cousin a few months ago because he didn't get treated. Had I not been treated, I would not have been able to see her do these things. I would not have been able to see her talk about those things. Yeah. You know, thanking God for the fact that she has gone through all of them successfully. Mm-hmm. I am very proud, very proud. And that's the importance. Take care of yourself so you can, you know, God has a life plan for you.
Yes.
Take care of yourself so you can live that plan.
Amen, amen. I didn't get to really introduce you guys, but you may remember Mr. Moore. He's been on the show several times. He's a prostate cancer survivor. He's educated you all several times about prostate cancer, but he's also on the board of the Arkansas Prostate Cancer Foundation, if I'm not mistaken. And his daughter has recently been on ABC World News. I know, because I love to watch that show. And I saw one evening last year, they had a photo of an all-black expedition to Mount Everest. They reached the top and they had this awesome photo op. And I was like, oh, wow, that is so awesome. And come to find out, one of the ladies on that team is Mr. Moore's daughter. And because he was treated, tested and treated successfully for prostate cancer, he got to see that moment. So welcome to the show, Miss Rosemary Saul. I'm so glad to have you with us. You know, given what your dad has been through, does that put that in perspective for you too? You know, that things could have been so different?
Absolutely. It does. It really does. And just hearing you talk about that now, Dad, like having that hit home of the many different directions that it could have gone in, but being very grateful that not only have I had his continued support, like throughout my whole entire life of mm-hmm. going in many different directions, exploring different adventures, doing all sorts of different things. He's been right there to support the whole time. I'm very grateful that that is still the case, and that we're still able to support each other as time goes on.
Well, if I remember correctly, your dad in and of itself is pretty athletic. I mean, he's a very healthy guy, so it sounds like you got a double dose of that gene.
Yes, ma'am. He definitely passed some of that on. It took some work, but he definitely passed some of it on.
She definitely took it to the next level.
Yeah. Cause I mean, you're like an avid biker, if I'm not mistaken. So what made you want to do, I don't know, mountain climbing instead of just, you know, biking like your dad or hiking or something like that, you know, around the little trails in the forest?
That is a great question. I think always from when I was young, I was always about climbing and getting on things. I've always loved, you know, heights and exposure. I would love, you know, looking over at the edge of a cliff, and I have people near me like, girl, what are you doing? You step back from that. Right. I would always love that sort of a thrill. And I remember when I was in middle school, because my dad is such an avid cyclist, always seen that throughout the years. And of course, he was trying to get me into cycling. He got me a bike, taking me out on bike rides. And then, of course, me being my little 13-year-old self, I was like, oh, like, whatever, Dad. Like, I don't know. I'm going to go climb these mountains. I'm going to go climb these trees. Like, I'm going to do this different thing. And I kept going in that direction, climbing, being in the mountains, being in the backcountry. Mm-hmm. I've almost come full circle now, because recently, in the past couple of years, I was able to get my dad help me get a bike, and we rode a Metric Century 60-mile bike ride together with my little cousin last year. I would like to ride a full 100-mile century with my dad, the events that I'd always seen him doing when I was younger. So it's coming full circle now. When I was 13, I was like, I want to do something different. But now I'm like, wait, Dad, can you tell me how you do this? Can you help me train? Can we go on a ride together?
Did you say 100 miles? But even with that, it's
the mountains and the smaller things. Yeah.
Did you say 100 miles on a bicycle?
Yes, ma'am. And my dad right here, just to hype him up right now, just to give him flowers, you talk about he's athletic. He doesn't just ride the 100 miles. He races the 100 miles. Wow. He would place to start at the front of the line. He would do the century in less than 5 hours, I think, 100 miles in less than 5 hours. That could take people 10 plus hours to do.
Wow.
He'd be racing. And so I'm trying to get to that level someday.
Look, if you can climb mountains for weeks at a time, it seems like you're probably close.
Maybe a little bit of training, maybe I can get there too.
Now look, I don't know what all William asked you guys, so if I, you know, if I ask you something you've already responded to, just let me know. We'll move on to the next question, but I really am interested in how somebody gets started in this, because it's one thing for me to climb Pinnacle Mountain, which, as your dad can tell you, is not really a mountain.
It's a lovely, beautiful climb.
Yeah, it's nice, and my legs shake like halfway. So I cannot imagine going for weeks at a time up and up and up to the highest point. And that's not the only place. I mean, you've been to Kilimanjaro. You've been to, Denali, that you went to? You've been to pretty much a lot of the famous scenic mountain, ranges and climbed the mountain. So how do you do that? Because, you know, if I go up Pinnacle Mountain, I may go up over there for a couple of hours and come back home, but you have to be gone for a significant amount of time from, you know, your other life. So how does somebody go about doing that and still, you know, have housing and not end up in bankruptcy when they come back home?
Yeah, that is very true. And that's a great question. And that is, I guess like the question, a persistent question, I would say, as well. I know I myself will sometimes explore that. Many folks that I know who do have that established passion and love and skill in the outdoors also have that question of, okay, do I pay my rent and like stay home and find a job, or do I pack everything up into the van and like go climb and go on this adventure? Right. So that is kind of a constant equation, I guess I would say, to figure out. But I've been very fortunate in that when I first got started of even getting into it, I just want to highlight that, you know, it didn't start when I was younger climbing on trees or rocks. Even as I first took my first course going into the mountains in a more formal setting that wasn't just, you know, climbing the roof of my school building after school when I wasn't supposed to, when I actually was learning these skills, it started small. It wasn't immediately like, I'm going to go for the tallest mountain in the world, or I'm going to go for the most technical or long-term adventures. It was like, okay, let's go to the climbing gym for the afternoon, or let's go out on a walk through the park. Mm-hmm. And then just developing that passion really started this, started me in taking bigger steps. So it didn't need to start big. And as well for me, my, life, this has turned into my career, where I will work in backcountry settings and in the mountains. And so it's part of my job to be gone for those periods of time. Right. And so structuring my life around that, but really it's just starting small and building that personal connection, and then finding the ways that can work, of what works with family, of what works with housing, of what works with career and jobs, and just figuring out how all of those puzzle pieces come together.
Now you all called your expedition Full Circle Everest Expedition, if I'm not mistaken. So was that one of those things that you had sponsors for, or because it was a group of you, it was a bunch of you together. How did you guys even decide to do it?
Yes. So that is a great question of how Full Circle even came about. And this is owed to Philip Henderson, who I'm sure you have seen and read. Philip Henderson is the team leader of Full Circle Everest. He had put this expedition together. He brought the team and all of the climbers together. And so really just huge shout out to Philip right now. He has been working in the outdoor realm, the outdoor sphere, for about 3 decades, a little more than 3 decades at this point. Mm-hmm. And especially as a dark-skinned black man in a predominantly white activity, he was just, you know, experiencing forms of just racism and microaggressions and that exclusion, and like before words like diversity, equity, and inclusion were like buzzwords and campaigns that organizations are now realizing that they got to get behind and support to change the narrative of the direction that this industry has taken. And so, and he has been having these conversations and pushing back on these systems even since then, like since the 90s, since he's been working in outdoor stores or as a river guide or as a backpacking instructor. And so he brought this team together, and he had even been to Nepal, been on Everest on a different expedition in 2012. Wow. And he was the only black individual on Everest. And since then, on his expedition, I should say, at that time, on his expedition, and like the classic, like the only one sort of experience. And again, a group of predominantly white teammates, as well as the support of the Sherpa community. The Sherpa community being the folks, the culture that called the Himalaya home. And so he built that relationship in Nepal over the past 20 years or so, and always said, okay, well, I'm building this relationship with the Sherpa community, with these people in Nepal, especially, you know, being a dark-skinned black man with dreadlocks, like that's not a sight that many trekkers see in Nepal, that the community in Nepal sees. And so he says, maybe they know me, but this community that I'm connecting with, they don't know us. And so I'd love to bring an expedition of black climbers back on the mountain to represent and to strengthen those intercultural, those global relationships, impacting both, the community in Nepal as well as the black community and beyond in the States. And so that was a lot of the journey right there. But, and so that was the impetus of bringing this team together. And so that is, especially with the name Full Circle as well. And yes, it was a conscious effort to receive funding and sponsorships, and something that the team worked really hard together on to secure, and that didn't necessarily come easily as we prepared for the climb.
And how many of you made the climb?
There were, in total, our team was, we had 11 folks on the Full Circle team who were coming to Nepal. Wow. 9 of those folks were on the climbing team, 2 were base camp support. We also had, our Sherpa team was about 32, so including the whole entire team, 50 plus. And then of the 9 folks who were on the climbing team, 7 made it to the summit push to take off for the summit day, and all 7 of those folks reached.
Wow, and you were one of those 7?
Yes, ma'am. One of those 7.
So how many women participated? Because it's, you know, it's one thing to have an all black expedition. That's awesome in and of itself. But then you had black women on the team too. So, how many black women were on your team?
There were, three on the team, on the whole team, two on the climbing team. One of the women on the team is, she is an engineer. She frequently works on boats in Antarctica for months at a time, taking care of equipment, and, she's pretty hardcore. She's pretty awesome. And, but she chose to stay and lend those skills to the base camp support. Wasn't interested in climbing, even though she is a mountaineer, but was interested in supporting the team. And so two of us were, as women, as female identified folks, were on the climbing team. Yes.
Wow. I gotta say, we can talk all day about the jokes about black people not climbing mountains.
We can do that all day.
And so I'm glad. You know, to get past that hump, that not only do we have African American people who are doing these type of athletic, outdoorsy things on a regular basis, it's their job, but there's a black woman who's in Antarctica.
Yes, absolutely. Working on the snow, hanging out with the penguins.
But that's the kind of stuff culturally we make jokes about. No, we're not doing that. But it's nice to know, that we are doing those things. And if there are those who are out there listening that have an interest in doing them, you've got people who've already broken those ceilings for you. You've got people who you can glean behind reapers. You can glean behind, as the Bible would put it, in order to make your particular goals come true. Yeah. But I've got to ask you this, because when I think about climbing a mountain, look, this was me. I'm just going to give you a real funny story. Before I met my husband, you know, I kind of gotten fed up with the dating scene, and I told the Lord, you know, I want him to just, you know, let whoever it is find me, and this is what I believe I want in a man. It wasn't what I believe. I just said what I wanted. And I said I wanted a guy who was adventurous. That's what I said. And so in comes Andre. And in his growing up here in Little Rock, Pinnacle Mountain was like his playground. And he didn't stick to the little, you know, the little climbing stair rocks. He would go around the side where they say no trespassing. And we were dating, and so he told me, you know, you want to climb Pinnacle Mountain with me? I'm like, oh, he is adventurous. We're going to go climb a mountain. I'm in love, right? And he took me up the rough side of the mountain. And, you know, I'm trying to impress him in the beginning. And, you know, I hate bugs and lizards and all of that. And he swore to me he'd never seen any of that stuff on there, that they've got signs saying you could possibly see this stuff. So, of course, those things decided to come out and meet me while we're going up the rough side of the mountain. And I'm about to fall. And I'm tired, and I'm like, okay, Lord Jesus, if you get me down off this thing, I will never and I have not gone up the rough side ever again. We have been together since 1995. Okay? And this happened around about 96 or something. I have never gone up that side of Pinnacle Mountain ever again. So how is it? I guess, do you, for me, it would seem like so uncomfortable to be cold and to be climbing and all of that. But is it fun for you? Is it the total opposite? Were you having a good time doing all that?
That is a great question. Well, first off, I'm curious, because I've only been at Pinnacle the one time on the main trail, so I'm curious kind of to see that other side around the mountain, the rough side. So
yeah, it's the rough side.
Maybe we'll get you back over to one of these days. Maybe bring that full circle.
Maybe you guys can meet and climb it together.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I'm going
to get some more work. Go up the mountain, because I told Jesus I wasn't going back.
I love it. But in terms of like being in many different environments, and sometimes it's the rocks and it's the mud and it's the snakes. Sometimes it's the ice and the snow and the cliffs. But, so there's something that we refer to a lot in different outdoor settings. It's like different types of fun. I think it applies in many settings, right? Like type one fun, type two fun. Type one fun is like, we're in the moment. I'm loving this. I'm having fun right now.
Right.
And I'll remember it fondly later. And then the type two fun comes in, and that's when that you're in the moment and it's like, why did I choose to do this? What am I doing here? I'm cold. I'm tired. My clothes are wet, et cetera, et cetera. And then you like sit down, get to camp, and it's like, wow, that was the best day ever. This is so fun. I love it. That climber's amnesia is another one.
Climber's amnesia.
You're like feeling the burn, questioning every step as you're moving, and then you stop and look around, and it's like, wow, this is the best thing ever. immediately forgetting how much you were suffering a moment ago. But I say that there's a lot of that in there. So even though there are some moments where, you know, blood, sweat, and tears on the rock wall, on the trail, sometimes questioning decisions, bigger picture, I just find so much joy even in that kind of physical suffering and moments, even through that physical challenge. Because that is part of what reminds me of why I love these activities so much, and what got me to take the first step in this direction in the first place is that sense of empowerment that can come from spending time in the mountains and pushing through that discomfort, or pushing through those many barriers that exist on a personal level, physical level, societal level, and just connecting with world wild spaces. And so that bigger picture draws into that joy.
William is sending me text messages to ask questions.
He didn't get all the questions out earlier.
He says, how far is the climb from the base camp to the summit of Mount Everest?
Well, for Mount Everest, the base camp is at, well, it's a whole, okay, so Mount Everest is located in the Khumbu Valley, and so you fly into an airport called Lukla Airport at 9,000 feet, and from there you're walking, because beyond that, all the village is only accessible by mule, foot, and then yaks, higher up. And so, we even though base camp is at 17,000 feet, and from there, that's what, 12,000 feet of elevation to the summit over a number of like linear kind of map miles. It's 30 miles and 8,000 feet to even get to base camp. And we're walking that too. So all in all, you're climbing a displacement of 20,000 feet, but of course there's ups and downs. Over like 30 to 60 miles to just the one way. And you gotta turn around and go back down and out.
Wow. So my understanding is at a certain point on Mount Everest, you know, people who didn't know, tried to climb before, then realized that, oh, we're running out of oxygen. It's a little light up here. And they, you know, succumbed to the mountain because they couldn't breathe. Did you all have to have additional oxygen with you and tote that up with you and so that you could breathe properly and continue going up the climb? Wow.
Absolutely. Yes, ma'am. So we had that supplemental oxygen. There are some folks who have climbed the mountain all the way to the top without any supplemental oxygen.
Wow.
And that is truly just superhuman, super status. That is absolutely incredible to me, because as you maybe have heard before, that zone elevation up above about 24, 25, 26,000 feet is referred to as the death zone, because that is where the oxygen is so thin that unless you are prepared or have that supplemental oxygen, it cannot sustain human life. So the fact that some folks have climbed all the way up without that supplemental oxygen is incredible. But that was not us. That was not us. We had our oxygen. We had our oxygen tanks. But I did have a close call. A couple of folks on the team had close calls where either my tank ran out at one point when I was still in that death zone. And thankfully somebody from a different team who was nearby saw that I was getting a little lightheaded. And he came in and gave me, I didn't realize until later on, gave me the oxygen tank off of his back.
Wow.
His name was Pemba. He's a guide on the mountain, but was not with our team, but still showed up and supported me in that way. Or someone on the summit, on the top of the world, there was an issue with the regulator. And so they went a few minutes without that oxygen while they had to switch it out and get it fixed. And so, so it is very real up there.
So how many oxygen tanks did you have to carry on your back while you're going up with other supplies? I mean, because it seems like that's heavy already.
Absolutely. Each full oxygen tank is 7 pounds-ish.
Wow.
But this is just a moment to, again, highlight the Sherpa community on the mountain, especially after the 2019 season where there was a record high number of deaths that it did occur that year. A lot of that having to do with issues with oxygen and with altitude and with just many folks crowded on the mountain as well and long kind of waiting times to move through bottleneck parts of the climb. We all had exceptional support of the Sherpa community, many of them again being a cultural identity group of people living in the Himalaya. Many of them work on the mountain because, you know, they call the Himalayas home. That's their backyard is Mount Everest, Mont Blanc, like all these mountains out there. And so, each person had like a Sherpa partner. And so me as a climber, as like a visitor to the mountain, a climber, the way that we had set it up was that I carried my oxygen tank that I was using. And then we had our partners who were carrying with us who carried the additional. I think that was only on the summit. We would change them out. We started at camp 3. There are 4 camps in between base camp and the summit. So, camp 2 to camp 3 to 4 to then summit day and back. So at least 3-4 nights that we were using oxygen. And so we went through about, at least just on the summit day alone, that was 2 canisters. But I had the one on my back and then Dawa, who was my partner on the mountain, had the extra, the backup as well. So just shout out the Sherpa community that happened. What was that? I'm sorry.
There's a trail that everybody follows. Wow.
Yes, ma'am. Yep, exactly. And that's again another because the folks working on the mountain, again, oftentimes from the Sherpa community and just recognizing how populated a climb Everest is. There are people who set the lines. It's a fixed line. So they're building anchors in the snow and ice and attaching a rope to it. And then climbers, we have what's called an ascender. It's a device that kind of hooks on and is like a progress capture, like it can slide up and then holds onto the rope that we use to kind of climb up and walk along the pathway.
Well, I guess it sounds like they've made it sort of a safer climb for
yes.
people by doing it that way.
Indeed. Wow. And there are some folks who do other routes on the climb where they'll go do their own thing or they'll climb unsupported, like without the support of too many guides or porters. But for the standard, South Col via South Col, cause there's also a couple of other routes on the mountain, but South Col is kind of the main, trade route you could call it on the mountain is pretty established.
Wow. I am so impressed. I am almost to the point where I have no words. I cannot believe it. I didn't know it was that much organization that went into the climb from the community. I thought, you know, that they were, you know, just, oh, there's a mountain with a lot of ice on it. Let's go see if we can conquer it. You know, just kind of did their own thing. But apparently, it sounds like that community has realized that this is a big tourist attraction and it is probably bringing in a lot of income for their community. And they've making this safer is probably going to be better for us financially. Mm-hmm. And they've seen the wisdom in, you know, okay, we'll figure out how to get them up there safely and support them and all this other stuff. So that sounds awesome. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a really wonderful thing. Well, so I have another logistical question because I know the climbing sounds rough, but you talked about reaching different summits. So you don't get to rest. You don't get to sleep. You don't get to eat or go to, you know, your business until you reach these different areas, like summit 1 or 2 or 3. Is that how that goes? Or, you know, how do you take care of your business? Because we're still doing it. You
know? Absolutely. Thankfully, there is opportunity. There is opportunity to do that in between, a little in between moments. Right. And that's why those camps are set up so that there are stopping points to stop and rest and refuel as you continue higher on the mountain. So base camp is at 17,000 feet and change. And that's kind of where we set up our camp, and have everything where, you know, we'll go up high, come back down. That's like our returning point. And that there were maybe, there are like over 1,000 folks who were at camp, if not like more between 1,000 and 2,000 people. It is literally a small city walking through it. It's over a mile from one end to the other. Walking through it, people have built pathways with the rocks and on the ice. And of course it's changing every year as the ice melts, but it was like, okay, we got this pathway over here. This is like this part of town. We got that part of town. We got the medical tent over here. And so down in those more established camps, there are like toilets where we're able to go, toilets that are, where the waste, the product is carried out. But, like bathrooms in between, we might go in bags. That is a common technique, is to do your business in a bag and then carry it with you until you can get it to a point of taking it out. And then each camp is a place to stop and rest. So camp one, we would spend a night there on one of our acclimatization routes. Camp two, we spent a couple of days. That's a bit more established, like a smaller version of base camp. Camp three, on the side of a cliff, you can kind of, not like a very steep snow slope, I'll say. You can rest and eat there. Same with camp four. So they're all places to eat and refuel. And of course, snacks and water as we're moving throughout the day as well. So we don't necessarily need to wait in between.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because it seems like it would, oh my gosh. William wants to know if there are any internet services on the mountain. They probably have satellite phones, I'm sure, but
yeah.
I don't know. Do they have a cell tower up there for you?
There are definitely satellite phones. I was able to text my dad from Camp 2, Camp 3, or my partner. But base camp, believe it or not, they have Wi-Fi.
Wow.
At Everest Base Camp. And I think that they're working on, one of the main providers in Nepal is working on installing a cell phone tower closer to base camp. Mm-hmm. But so it is actually kind of wild that you're out there so far out and I can update my social media or talk on the phone. But yeah.
Well, you know, you mentioned the ice melting. Was it really evident, you know, that climate change was affecting this mountain as even as you were climbing it?
Absolutely. Even just seeing, there are so many different ways it was evident. For one, because we set up our base camp and that's there for about like a little over a month or so. And that's on the ice, what's called like moraine covered glacier, moraine being like the rocks and the dirt and stuff that gets on top. And so we have our tents on there and we would have to rebuild the tent platforms because you would wake up one day and there's like a little dip in under your tent because things are melting out underneath it. So we'd have to reinforce the platforms there. We went through something called the Khumbu Ice Fall, which is one of the most dangerous parts of the climb. And it's an ice fall, which is pretty much just, as you can imagine, like a waterfall, but made of ice. And there are big chunks of ice called serac that can kind of come off at any moment. We passed through there about 3-4 times. Every time it was a different route because there had been avalanches inside that took out part of the route. So they had to build a different route. There are chunks of ice that would fall. And even on our way out the last day, it was almost like a waterfall in some moments where things were melting versus how it was at the start of the climb when things were still more solid and frozen. So many different ways that you could see how it's being impacted.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And the National Geographic team was also on the mountain at the same time.
Really?
They have incredible documentaries of what they have been able to do. They installed a weather station up at an area called Bishop's Rock, which is just below the summit. So I think at the time that they installed it, it was the highest elevation weather tower. Mm-hmm. And they have done research just showing, from a more scientific perspective, like meteorologists and glaciologists showing the impacts of climate change and just how much things are melting. And so it's very, it was great to be able to learn from them on the mountain as well.
Wow. You know, it's, I don't remember the exact date. Was it during the summer months that you all made the climb or was it wintertime?
Late spring. So it was, May, April to May.
Okay. Yes. So I know that there in different parts of the world, summers have been excruciatingly hot, and dangerous. And I think in parts of India, that's actually been the case. So is it impacting, you know, like when you're at the base of the mountain, I know the weather is obviously different, but was it totally different when you were there to see how the weather was impacting? It sounds like a tourism industry that they have versus maybe the way it was like in 1963 or, you know, years before.
Mm-hmm. I can only imagine that it has impacted. Of that, I'm not 100% sure. Just in the summer, I know the summer months, I think it does also get quite hot up there. Even though the ice and the snow, once you're at base camp and higher, because it is glacier, it stays all year long. That ice does not melt and refreeze, it stays. But there, it has been showing that that ice is, even that ice is like melting and the glaciers are receding. Many glaciers in the world, that's as even if y'all have heard, are receding. And so that's the case there as well. But even down lower, that is starting to like impact, like has the potential to impact water, since a lot of that melt is where like water sources for the villages all throughout the valleys come from. And so I think that they're still figuring out like how that will directly impact just the well-being of the folks in those communities, as well as folks coming to that environment to climb, like the tourism and trekking industry, which, as you had mentioned earlier, is a huge part of the livelihood of folks in this part of the world.
Wow. I know I've kept you guys over, due to the technical difficulties, but you know, what would you say to anybody out there who is interested, you know, who's like, you know, my husband is the type of person who, you know, when bungee jumping was a thing, he bungee jumped, you know, he is the type of person who would probably do this. And I know it's my own fault because I prayed for that. But he's the type of person, you know, who would do something like that, who would jump out of a plane, you know, for fun, that type of stuff. What do you say to the people who are brown, you know, and who have grown up in a culture like, we don't do that. But they actually do want to do that.
Exactly. Well, that was the biggest thing, is just in reference to what you were saying earlier about those jokes. Like, it is often said, it's like a joke, right? It's like, what do you do? Oh, no. Black people don't do that. Black people don't do that. Mm-hmm. And even me being, you know, multiracial and as ambiguous as I know I am as well visually, I've even heard those same comments of like, oh, what, you say climb? No, that's the white side of you. Black people don't do that. And like, I can't even tell you how many times. And so that would be a huge, especially to all the black and brown folks out there, where we get enough of those sort of outside obstacles and messages telling us that we can't or that we don't belong from the outside. And so acknowledging that even if it's a joke, that can become a very real, like self-fulfilling prophecy, or can be a very limiting mindset. And so changing that, black people don't, whatever, .. whatever follows, to black people do. Like, we're out here, and it's not to prove anything to anybody. A lot of the comments that we got was like, oh, like, leave that for the white folks. Like, why, like, we don't need to prove anything. It's not about proving anything. It's just, it's joy and it's adventure and it's just truly fun and just contributing to just that, like, that liberation and that freedom and that empowerment for us. And so, and acknowledging that if it's not for you, that's totally fine. Like, you know, if you don't want to go around the rough side of Pinnacle, or if you don't want to climb Mount Everest, that's like, there's nothing wrong with that, but it is not because of, oh, black people don't do that. If you don't want to do that, that's fine, but we do. We are out here and we have been out here. And so just encouraging folks to keep pursuing any of those interests that might fall into that category.
Speaking of those interests, you've got another climb coming up soon, right?
I do. I'll have another, a work expedition. I'll be going out on a 30-day backpacking trip coming up in the next month or so.
Wow. Well, we are so very proud of you, and all that you've done. You make us look good. I ain't climbing Everest, but I'm glad to know you did. and that there are a lot of other people who look like me, who don't have a problem, climbing Everest, living in Antarctica for months, and doing all those things that people think, that folks that look like us won't or can't do. Back to you, Mr. Moore. And you've had time to get yourself together. So you might be ready to talk again. You know, this is Prostate Cancer Month, and I think this is, you know, as I said earlier, a perfect way to encourage men to do what they have to do, even though it may be uncomfortable, even though it may be something that they don't necessarily want to do, so that they can be around for these kinds of moments. Can you tell the men out there, you know, what they need to do, in order to get tested, and, you know, just if somebody has had it, give them a little bit, or have been diagnosed with it recently, give them some encouragement.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Opening statement, opening comment is that prostate cancer is one of the cancers that, if caught and treated early, it's almost 100% curable. There are different treatment options. The test, everybody should start testing around the age of 45 to 50-ish. If you have a family history, get tested earlier. Testing is a matter of having your PSA checked. It's a blood test, and you can do that. And they can let you know if your PSA is elevated or not. There are many people that simply are not aware, and that's where the problem comes in, because they don't know what a PSA is. They don't know the need to get it checked. Like I am sometimes, if I'm feeling good, I don't need to go to a doctor. Well, right. High blood pressure is called the silent killer. Same thing with prostate cancer. You don't always have symptoms, so you don't know that you have it. So be proactive. Talk to your doctor. Check your PSA. Stay in touch with it. Know your family history. If you have a family history, you might even want to start getting checked earlier. Mm-hmm. But get checked. Because like I said, God has a plan for you. There are things happening in your life. What I have to say about Rosemary is simply stated, that's my daughter. I'm so proud of her. And I was serious about the comment of, you know, not having a tissue with me, because I know there are many people that have wanted to do things that didn't have anyone to help them or show them do it. I used to coach cycling for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. And when people would finish an event, they would be emotional because they did it. Well, mm-hmm. Rosemary leads expeditions. And mm-hmm. when she takes people through that fear point, mm-hmm. they're able to do something they thought was never possible. I can imagine how they feel. So, you know, stay healthy so you can, one, participate in these things, and two, enjoy the moments of celebration with those that are close to you.
Awesome. Awesome. Perfect advice. Y'all, this has been a blessed show in spite of the devil trying to ruin it for me. I was ecstatic about this show, and I'm glad I got to actually do it, and William didn't get to steal it all.
Shucks.
All the thunder.
And I'm sorry, and I'm sorry that you had some technical difficulties, but I had a blast in your absence. And that's right. And that's coming from you. You know, Anne's going to accuse me, Rosemary and Dwight tomorrow of stealing her guests again. All right. And I kind of admitted a little bit, but I kind of choose, I like the word smuggle. Stealing doesn't sound quite right. So I'm your resident smuggler. I have no problem.
You do know that's a synonym for steal, right?
Okay, all right. But I do want to say something about what Dwight just said. Oh, Rosemary, you are absolutely delightful. Yes. Before I go to Dwight. And guess what? I just thought about something. We're going to have Rosemary and Dwight on the Boomerang Radio Show.
Now, see, hold on.
And cultural excellence.
Talk to her about doing Teens Talk Truth. The woman is busy. She got somewhere to be.
I know. I'm talking about, you know, in between, you know, her ventures and things like that, right?
Okay. Right. He's gonna be blowing up y'all's phone trying to just get ready.
That depends on whether Ann gives me the number or not. She might have to hold back.
But you have Mr. Moore's number.
Uh-oh. Okay, we're right there. All right, good enough. No, but this has been an amazing interview. I listened to the entire broadcast, and Ann was right. And I was texting her some questions again, right? You know.
We read. You heard me read the questions, and they answered them. So
you sure did.
You can't say I didn't cooperate with you.
You did.
Although you had like 30 minutes.
I sure did. I enjoyed every minute of it too. And also, but I do have to say something more on a serious note, and that is, I only learned about the PSA when you were doing the show with Dwight. And I forgot the other gentleman's name that was on with you. But I learned about that. I took the PSA, and I love that one. I'll take the PSA anytime. And I think I might have another one coming up. But I don't know. How often do you need to test, Dwight? Should it be every year, or what would you suggest?
Every year
would
be a great way to start. If you have a family history, that frequency might change because of that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to get it done again this year. I had it done last year. I'm going to do it again this year. Yeah. Thanks to you. I really appreciate it. All right. Back to you, Ann.
Yes, it's William has proven again he's a big baby. As long as it's a needle, he's okay. anything else. But I'm just glad you're willing to get stuck with a needle.
You can say what you want. I don't care. As long as I get it done.
Exactly.
I don't care, William. Thank you for being honest. Thank you for once. anyway, y'all, thank you for giving us a little bit extra time because so that I could fulfill my dream of this interview. Thank God that, you know, we were able to work things out. But Rosemary and Mr. Moore, y'all have been perfect. And I appreciate you giving me a little extra moments with you to have this discussion. Unfortunately, I have run over into the Teens Talk Truth radio show's time. For those of you who aren't familiar with Teens Talk Truth, well, it's a show hosted by my favorite young men on the planet, my sons, AJ and Alex Taylor. And they talk about hot topics affecting teens in our society today. So you don't want to miss it because they also, because they're my kids, they like to do funny stuff like their little segment called What Had Happened Was. And oh my gosh. They did one recently that I went into full black mama mode on the radio. I was like, don't you ever let me find out that you did something like what you just read about ever. But anyway, you don't want to miss it. So keep it locked right here. And then come back tomorrow night at 5 o'clock p.m. Central Time for the Boomerang Radio Show, which is hosted by me, Reverend Dr. Rudolph Demery, Dr. Cecilia Sims, and of course, William, because this is William's therapy session.
That's right.
For the week. And who knows what he will be griping about, and we will help work him through his emotional distress. So the whole one who missed it is always fun. Dissecting William's psyche.
Exactly right.
We basically talk about current events, or, you know, whatever William wants to talk about. You know, sometimes we talk about things like domestic violence, prostate cancer. Other times we talk about politics. So you just never know what you're going to get. What we do, even though we're talking about serious topics, is we have a whole lot of fun. So we will make you laugh to keep from crying, if nothing else. So tune in tomorrow night, 5 o'clock p.m. Central Time, right here on Studio W Buzz. And don't forget to come back next Saturday at 11 o'clock a.m. Central Time for the Eating is an Act of Worship Ministries radio show. We'll see you then. Have a blessed week.
Hey, thank you so much, Mr. Moore, Dwight Moore, Rosemary. Delightful and great as usual. And ladies and gentlemen, in case you're listening via Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter, we also have apps that you can download. And now jot this down. If you have an Apple device, just go to your Apple App Store and download Studio.W. Studio.W, Android, Studio W. We're available on Alexa, Google Play, Apple CarPlay, and this broadcast is also on iTunes as well as Spotify. So, ladies and gentlemen, keep it locked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Music, talk, sports, comedy, entertainment, and a whole lot more. It is the baddest on the planet, Studio W, The Buzz, and I'll see you tomorrow. Rosemary and Dwight, thank you so much. Have a great Saturday.
Thank you. You as well.
Thank you so much for having us.